is Professor Tim Arnold. Professor Tim Joseph. His presentation is bigger, still better, considerations in increasing the size of haulage equipment. Tim is president and principal engineer, JPI Mine Equipment. Dr. Joseph is a recognized expert in mine equipment performance related to ground equipment interactions. He delivers certificated industry short courses and mining equipment performance evaluations to global resource industries. Dr. Joseph is also the Associate Dean of Engineering and Professor with Mining Engineering from the University of Alberta and Director of the Alberta Equipment Ground Interaction Syndicate AEGIS Research Program. How about a warm welcome for Dr. Joseph?
Well, hello everyone. How's everyone doing? It's pretty good. You know, Slank, this is my favorite conference. I've been coming here since 2001 when we were down in Tucson, right, Steve? 2001, we're in Arizona in Tucson. And so, you know, it's great to see so many of you return. There's some old friends I can see here, some faces. Some of us getting a little grayer. You're getting grayer. You are, I'm looking at you. You're getting grayer. Okay, we're definitely getting grayer. Even Humi, this is my colleague from the university. So even Humi is going a little gray. I remember him when he was a student and the hair was jet black. Things are definitely changing. But it's also good to see so many younger people coming out that haven't been here. Maybe it's your first experience coming to this conference. I really would encourage you to continue to support haulage and loading in the future. And I'm sure it will, you know, become even more, be larger groups of people coming as the economy returns. And I do believe it's returning. It does seem that we're actually getting to a point where we have pretty much a 30% increase since this time last year in terms of activity, in terms of people taking up people back into the industry. So I think we truly are on a rebound. So things are looking hopeful, and hopefully that is good news for haulage and everything else that we're doing here. This piece of work started out many years ago, and it really is not a difficult concept of what we looked at, but it really came about around 1998, 99, when we saw the advent of essentially what we started terming the ultra-class truck. And this is where we saw the first 797, the first 930 concept coming out. We saw the 282, and we saw a number of other models from other different manufacturers appearing. The 5500 from Hitachi was still on the drawing board. But things were developing fast. And we made a huge leap of faith at that time. We jumped from 240-ton class suddenly to 320 and 360. And we'd never done that before. We'd come from jumps of 20, 30 tons where we'd gone 170, 200, 220, 240, suddenly we jumped almost 100, 120 tons in one go. And we all questioned at that time, was bigger better? And in fact, back in 2000, we held a conference in Alberta, in Edmonton, Alberta. There was Ian Muirhead had just passed away, who was a very, very big proponent of equipment size in our industry. And Bruce Regensburg and a couple of others put together a conference with me. And we basically asked the question, is bigger better? And you should have seen the arguments in the room. So we had manufacturers. We had, Ted Kress was still alive. Ted was in the room and he was flailing around demanding that people don't go too big. And he was showing his new suspension design at the time, which eventually became part of Caterpillar. But things were changing, and we saw a lot of people really pushing from the industry to see bigger equipment. And everyone had the thought that if we went bigger, our costs would drop. That was the real driver. We went bigger, we made that jump of 100, 120 tons, things would actually drop and we wouldn't see as big costs. And that's really what pushed this thing. And so everyone kept moving forward. And nobody wanted to stop and check. Everyone wanted to keep progressing forward and say, yes, bigger has to be better. Not is it better, but it has to be better. And so, you know, I look at my colleague at the back of the room, Roger Thompson, and Roger will tell you, bigger did not seem to be better when we were looking at roads and the type of materials we had available in our minds to actually construct them. And I'm sure he'll be talking some more about that later on this week. But overall, we weren't convinced, but we put so much into it, both as OEMs and as end users, as operators, that nobody wanted to take a step backwards and say, did we make a mistake? And to be perfectly honest, I don't think we did, but we did make some hiccups along the way. The first thing was that we knew with the 240-ton class, the 830s, the 793s, and the like, at that class size, we were starting to see some real structural problems in maintenance. We were seeing more cracks in frames around banjo housing near final drive systems. We were seeing more fatigue than we'd ever seen before. And so the OEMs, and those of you in the room that are OEMs, you guys remember in the late 90s, early 2000s, we talked about if we make the frame stiffer, it will last longer. And everyone said, you make it rigid, how can it break? Well, if you make it rigid and it can't flex, it can do nothing but break. And so in the first series, the 797As, the first 930s, we saw more cracks earlier than we'd seen before. And everyone realized you can't go stiffer. So we added back the torsion tubes. We added back the drawn steels instead of the cast steels. And we started to see some improvements. And everyone said, okay, we're back on track. We've made improvements. And everyone was comparing the improvement to the damage they'd just seen with the first advent of those units. But we really hadn't gone back to actually look at the comparison is bigger, better. We lost redundancy. One of the reasons that most of us went from fairly large equipment like drag lines, bucket wheel excavators, and we moved over to truck and shovel in the first place in the 80s was to increase the redundancy in our system. So if you lost one unit, you kept running. If you lost one truck, didn't matter, you had a fleet of 20. But when we started going to the larger truck sizes, you didn't need as many trucks to do the same production. And so we lost some of our redundancy. And we lost sight of that a little bit. So all those things aside, there's some things that people like Hooman and I looked at, and we said, okay, hold on a second. You're going to increase your fleet size. What does this do to your mine plan? If we want to continue to have MSHA and various different local safety association standards associated with road widths, if you've got a bigger truck, you need a wider road. And so some of us got around that by saying, okay, we'll just do one-way traffic so we don't have to increase the size of the roads. And the consequence of that was our accidents went up. We started having very near misses or side collisions. Things started to go wrong. And so the need was to increase the road width. But we never really looked back and said, okay, what does this really cost us in additional production requirement to prepare to mine even before you start pulling ore? What happens to your stripping ratio? What happens to your ability to build a well-constructed road? Because now the road is bigger, and so you need more good quality subgrade material, capping material, which really pushes you over the limit. How much do you actually have available on your mine site? And some of the mine sites that I've looked at, particularly in Western Canada, the road material isn't great. We have these clay shales that as soon as it starts to freeze, thaw, or starts to rain, it just turns to pulp. And then you have a slip slide going down a ramp. And then you've got a nightmare on your hands. Things start to go wrong. So that's where this stuff came from. So what happens when you increase size? What happens when you look at a larger sized model truck? The roads definitely need to be wider. Our standard right now is at least 3 to 3.5, preferably 3.5 times the width of your truck, so you can have two trucks pass with a reasonable degree of safety. And now many of us are looking at autonomous. We're saying, it's okay, the autonomous system will look after itself. But what is the tolerance associated with things that are picked up by the radar system, the LiDAR system, by the truck in close proximity to the edges of those roads that causes the truck to actually vary its position a little bit? You definitely still need the 3.5 times, because there's going to be that much variability, even with autonomous. Does anybody here who's worked with autonomous know if there's actual health and safety jurisdiction in place right now for using those trucks? The answer is there isn't. In Alberta, where Hooman and I come from, in Alberta, we don't have any legislation yet. We're about to probably go into a provincial, a state election, very quickly here within the next 18 months, which means even if you had something going for approval by the local government, they will never do that before they go into an election because they want to piss off people. And it'll be at least probably 3 years from now before we get it through. So if you're actually starting autonomous, which Suncor is with Fort Hills project up in northern Alberta, are we going to be able to get anything past a small test fleet into a production fleet? The answer is no, you're waiting 3 years because there's no OH&S legislation to cover it. No one's written it yet. And even if we wrote it as a user group, as a manufacturer group, and we present to the government, they still have to write it themselves in their speak. They'll want to review, and they don't have to accept anything we say. They can write whatever they want. So we're really caught between our own acceleration in terms of that side of the business. Operating space needs to be bigger. So if you get down to the bottom, you think about the lowest point of your pit. You need to have sufficient space at the bottom of the pit to be able to turn around safely to operate your loading fleet and your hauling fleet. Thinking about how many units could be down there to ensure you get a reasonable exchange of vehicles so you can keep your production coming out of the pit. We need to get larger stripping ratios, and I'll show you this in a second. But honestly, when you look, you think, well, that's really obvious, and it is obvious. But the thing is, we've kind of forgotten it along the way in terms of the total cost of what this means. Higher competency in road construction materials. You have a bigger truck. The truck actually puts down more load on its tires onto the ground. If we knew what the footprint area of the tire is, and we know the load from the suspension system as it loads the ground, that pressure on the ground will cause the ground to deform. Ground has a stiffness. It's easily measured. You can take a little plate off a little jack system off the back of your hitch of your light vehicle, and whatever the diameter of the plate is, you can work out the area, you get the load, you actually get a pressure and a deformation. That's a pressure stiffness. It's a real easy test to do. Anyone can do it. I have guys all over the world doing this in their minds, taking pressure stiffness of ground materials. That gives you the first instance of what do you get in terms of an immediate deformation. But if you cycle it, you can actually get a cyclic deformation as if the tire on the ground is going on and off. That tells you the rate of deformation of your ground. So you can get an idea of how much it's going to deform with time for different materials. So looking for higher competency ground materials, if you have a higher pressure from your tires, if you've got a higher stress, a higher load from your tires onto the ground, you're going to get more deformation. So it's going to deteriorate more. So that means more road maintenance. That means higher rolling resistance. Our rolling resistance is directly related to the amount of ground deformation. There's higher rolling resistance. Higher rolling resistance, longer cycle times, more fuel burn, more emissions. Wow. This could actually cost us a lot because we've got a larger truck putting down more load. Now, if you look at most of the road analysis tools that are out there, whether they're numerical or whether they're hand calculation, most of them are based on what is the distributed load onto the tires when it's low? What's the gross vehicle weight divided by six tires? What is that load? But that's not the load on the ground, right? And Roger will tell you the load on the ground as the truck moves along the surface could be anything between that and 2 to 3 times its weight because the truck bounces around. So your actual load on the ground at any point could be static, but it could also be dynamic. And if it's dynamic loads, we haven't even really thought about that in terms of what does that do to the deterioration rate of our ground materials. What it means is even higher maintenance for roads, even higher stresses associated with the ground through to the frame, through to the suspension. That's why we ended up with cracks back in the 1990s, 2000s when we tested the first 797, 930 series. That's why that happened. So we need to find more good quality road construction materials. And you guys tell me, are they out there? And the answer is, we've only got what we've got on the site. We're not going to start buying stuff and bringing it in. It's going to be hard to find. Higher fuel requirements for the same tier engine. So if you compare tier engine to tier engine, you're going to see higher fuel requirements. How many people have gone from tier 2 to tier 3? Anyone in the room? There's an operator that's done tier 2, tier 3? Anyone gone to tier 4? Anyone still below tier 2? Nobody wants to admit this. And you guys know the answer. We went to tier 2, and actually we probably achieved tier 2. I honestly believe we actually achieved tier 2. We tried to go to tier 3. We have never achieved tier 3. we've never achieved really beyond tier two. And the reason for that is when the engine has to work hard, when the rolling resistance gets higher, when the road deterioration is higher, then you not only are having a bad fuel burn, but what goes out of your exhaust is not just NOx, carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, but it's also the hydrocarbon itself, it's the fuel. It bypasses the system. There's a pressure relief process in our engines that when things get too hard for the engine, it bypasses to let the energy go out the system. So it's gone. So now our emissions are hydrocarbons as well. And what's amazing is the level of the hydrocarbon emission post tier two is roughly the same as the NOx emissions. It's almost in parallel, gram per horsepower hour. It's almost the same. I actually asked two of the manufacturers in this last month. I sat them down for lunch. I bought them lunch. That doesn't happen very often. I bought them lunch. God, what am I doing? I bought them lunch and I said, guys, be honest with me. Did we ever get beyond tier two? And they looked at each other, and they're two competitors. And they grinned at me and they said, well, it's been difficult. They didn't say yes. So that tells you we're still struggling on emissions, which is probably one of the first and foremost things that we're getting dinged on in the industry by governance, regardless of what level it's at, because we're not meeting emission standards. Rolling resistance and cycle times. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. So I had a great master's student that came through the university. Her name was Magreth Dotto. She was very enthusiastic. She was also very pregnant when she was doing a master's degree, so she had an incentive to get done because the baby was coming. So she actually got this work done in rapid fashion. So I said to her, pick three models, and I said, I don't really care which manufacturer it is. She decided to pick on CAT because she could get information on it. That's the only reason she chose CAT. So not that I got anything against CAT, I don't. But essentially, she looked at the 785, the 793, and the 797. And I asked her to actually, okay, let's take a look at what these units use. And overall, I need to go back. There we are. So overall, given on the tire size, she figured out the stress on the ground statically, so 1G, not moving. 523 kPa through to 754 kPa. So we're looking at a stress level that increased. That means the deformation of the road surface would have increased. That means the rolling resistance would increase. That means the actual thickness or the quality of the material needs to improve to be able to combat that in terms of the road surface. But overall, when we look at the loads that you're actually supporting in terms of gross vehicle weight, and this is in metric tons, we went from 250, 390 to 620, 325 in that range. There's that huge jump. Look at this jump. This jump is massive. That was that leap of faith in the late 90s that we made, and we just kept going. This is what we're talking about in terms of the stripping ratio issue. When we look at the mine itself, and we have a slope that looks like this that worked really well for a 785 or a 793, when we went to the large class truck, when we went ultra class, we now had to have a bigger bench width. We had to have bigger road width, ramp width, to get up our slope. So if we did a couple of switchbacks to get to the top, this would be the amount of material we'd have to excavate to create that if we were going to do it into the wall of the rock. I'm not even going to talk about the opportunity that we might have to extend out and create larger ramps by putting loose material there, because we know what happens with that. It never does get compacted. It's free-flowing dump material off the edge of a crest. You're not going to get the compaction you need, and so the safety issues go through the roof. So looking at this ratio, you can see there is a definite increase in the volume. But what do those volumes actually look like? Well, in terms of constructing the roads, the ramp volume we'd have to cut to get just the ramp increase is a difference of 550,000 cubic meters to go from an 85 to a 93, and about 380,000 additional to go from a 93 to a 97. So you add these two together to go from 85 to 97. But that's only a piece of the puzzle. If you wanted to cut this ramp into the wall, then this is the amount of material you're actually excavating to actually do that, to create that ramp for a 785, you've got 1.2 million cubic meters more to go to a stage up. And if you want to go again, it's 2.9. So that really is a 4.1 million cubic meter increase to go from an 85 to a 97, from those class size to that class size. Does that cost you more money? Hell yeah. That costs you a lot of money. So making the decision to go bigger, these are the extra costs that people seem to have forgotten about in the system when they design their mines. If I look at the stripping ratio, so the red line is meters cubed per ton, and the blue one is meters cubed for meters cubed. So this is assuming a certain density associated with the material. So here, if we look at this, we've gone from 12 to roughly 18. So to go from the 785 to the 797, we saw our stripping ratio increase by 50%. The whole stripping ratio by 50%. If you presented that to the mine manager, he would say, what the hell have you done? Mind you, he does that anyway to the engineers in the planning office. But honestly, this is not acceptable. Unless you can show that you can actually see the costs covered by some form of revenue at the end of the day. Because your costs are increasing, where's the increase in revenue? Overall, you probably have the same size ore body, you're producing the same size ore, maybe a little quicker. But what's the economy look like? If the economy is today, maybe you don't want to produce as fast as you did 10 years ago. So there's a whole bunch of other factors that come into play with this. If I look at the road construction materials, and I actually asked Magreth when she was doing this study, I said, just pick some materials. And she got really optimistic about the surface course at a CBR of 95. I said, really? I said, okay, run with it. It's a relative thing. Let's just run with it as an example. I've never actually seen surface course material at 95. I've never found, not within an operating mine. You have to buy this beautiful crushed stone to get to that effect. And so if I look at Thompson Visser's critical strain estimates, and this is built off a number of different researchers, but essentially, if I looked at our case of our three trucks and I took a 20% overload, transformed that into the gross vehicle weight, that now is close to 700 tons metric for the 797, how many units you would need to get yourself the same 1,000 tons per day operating capacity out of a fairly reasonable-sized mine? How many cycles would be needed? But what would actually happen to your road surface? So the higher the strain, the greater the deformation. This is literally telling us that our critical strain for that period of time of that usage is increasing vastly. This tells us we really need to have either better materials to be able to do this, we need to have thicker layers within our road structure to be able to combat and actually work even despite this. So if I look at the road thicknesses, this was Magreth's estimate. So the 785, she had a sub-base of 1.68 meters. She had a base of 0.72 and 0.81. And this is what it transforms into to be able to cope with the additional loads put down by an ultra-class truck. This is where we came from. This is where we are. Have we actually changed the way we design roads since the 793s? And in most minds, the answer is no, we're still constructing roads the same way, and we're wondering why we're doing more road maintenance. This is why. The thicknesses are wrong. For the same materials, for the same quality materials on the mine site, the thicknesses are wrong. If I look at a ramp design for a 100-meter depth pit, design widths for the roads for different model trucks, the turning radius needed at the bottom, the switchback lengths associated with the ramp going up. But look at the pit slope angles, the affected pit slope angles. And this comes down to what would the final pit slope look like. With these, we could actually stay fairly close to the 70 degrees. But going with a larger truck, this just tells you there's that much more volume involved in terms of creating that ramp. So looking at the ramp construction materials, this is literally the cumulative volume by layer in thousands of meters cubed, we're getting up into that 300,000 range in total when we've come from about 225 or from about 140 in total. This is just the ramp. This is just the quality materials we got to do, put in place, if we have nothing cut into the rock itself. So looking at the volume comparisons, if we compare moving from a 793 to a 785, or from a 785, there is a 67% increase. From a 93 to a 797, 48, and 146 overall to go from 85 to 97. This is how much additional construction material you need, or what is the percentage you need increase over the whole transition from 85 to 97. This just tells you how much volume you're dealing with. I talked a little bit about fuel at the beginning. If I look at, and these numbers are taken from a number of different studies. There was David Leslie back in 2000 that did some study for the SMART Group, the Surface Mining Association of Research and Technology. Golders have done some studies over the years. And this is in different mines. This is in soft rock, hard rock mines, which is why there's a little scatter in the data. But overall, there is definite a trend of some description. Now, whether it's linear or whether it's a power curve or exponential, I honestly can't really tell from that. But if we just do a simple linear estimate, essentially we can see that as with increasing payload size, our fuel consumption went down per ton. But if you start multiplying by the number of tons, it actually goes a little bit in the other direction. But per ton, and this is what the OEMs have always said, we would see better fuel consumption. They're absolutely right, per ton. I can't fault them on that. But essentially, we are seeing this definite trend. We can predict. But remember, it's per ton. So if you have a 400-ton truck, you need to multiply by 400. If you have a 300-ton truck, multiply by 300. You start to see for your trucks what your actual fuel usage would be in liters per hour. And this is based on Tier 2, and I have to admit there were some claimed Tier 3s in here. But overall, if I see a trend that looks as good as this, that tells me they're all running around the same type of engine, regardless of whether they claim it's Tier 2 or Tier 3. In terms of emissions, and again, the same piece of work from Leslie and others, using this level of fuel and this amount of power being generated, they were looking at nitrous oxides, carbon monoxides, and hydrocarbons, and particulates being produced. Now, one thing I have to say is we're actually getting pretty good at capturing particulates. It's just, what are we doing the rest of our fuel burn? That's the real question. So if I look at rolling resistance, remember I said that rolling resistance is definitely related to fuel burn and fuel usage. If I look at the fuel consumption, we can see that the 797 is definitely doing much better in terms of fuel usage compared to the other two models. So the larger trucks are doing better. But remember, it's per ton when you look at it per ton. So you multiply by your tonnage of your truck, you're actually getting a little bit of a mixture in terms of the performance. If I look at the emissions, there's some really odd-looking relationships. So I split this up into flat ground conditions. You'd expect to be somewhere in this range. You wouldn't really want to be any more than that in terms of just having a rolling resistance. So this would just be rolling resistance represented down here. Once you get into ramp conditions, you now got rolling plus ramp percentage. And then when you get in some real steep rolling resistance, this is oil sands region. This is where we live up here. We live in this realm. It's a nightmare. But you can see the 797 is showing per ton it to be the better unit. So bigger in this case is could be perceived as being better. Carbon monoxide, similar relationships. So we can see those things appearing very much the same. Particulate emissions actually have a linear relationship. And that's because there's so little data available to be able to monitor this. We're not really even monitoring particulates anymore because they're so low. And when you look at the values, these are grams per hour per ton. We're in the 0.5 to 3.5 range. If I look back at our carbon monoxide, we're in the up to 120. So particulates are a tiny proportion of things we're talking about, whether it's carbon monoxide, whether it's noxious gases, the emissions for particulates really are very, very small. So I don't think they're things we need to really worry about. So let's come back to this. So I've shown you for the different model trucks, the different size trucks, for a truck increase, we did see definite lowering of emissions per ton. But if I now look at this truly at grams per hour for all truck models, even though there's a lot more scatter in the data, which I told you there would be scatter, it's a little bit all over the place, the definite trends, and this is to almost a 90% correlation, even with this data range, we're actually seeing very predictable trends for NOx and carbon monoxide, regardless of what truck it is, which tells me the trucks really are behaving all the same in terms of their tier 2 classification. They really have not improved very much. So let's take a step backwards. I wanted to show you something here, really around what we can do to get a better handle on how well our roads are performing so that we can bring those emissions down. We can see that there's an increase in emissions, there's an increase in fuel usage with an increase in running resistance. Well, what if we could get this thing down? How do we measure running resistance? Some of you say it's something to do with the torque off the motor, at the wheels. Yeah, it is. And in fact, torque or a moment at the wheels is the definition of running resistance. So what it depends on is the force, the load on the tire, and the distance between the center of the tire and the expected point of contact with the ground. But what it doesn't take account of is very often the tire is actually sinking into the ground material. In fact, the ground is deforming more often than not with running resistance. And so there actually is an angle, which is this funny looking E here, this XCE, which essentially is proportional to the running resistance percentage. It's actually directly proportional. So what we need to figure out is how much does the tire deform and how much does the ground deform? Well, I already told you how to get ground deformation. You take a little circular plate, you figure out what the area of the plate is, you load it off the back hitch of a truck, and you figure out for whatever loads, how much does that ground deform? So you can figure out your ground deformation. So if you know what the pressure is on the ground by the tire, you put the same pressure onto that plate on the ground off the hitch of your light vehicle, you figure out what the deformation is, that is the same deformation that would be under the tire for the same pressure. If you cycle it, it gives you the steady changing deformation associated with cycling activity of a tire on the ground. So that's the ground deformation. What about tire deformation? Do we have any tire manufacturers in the room? Any tire suppliers? Must be one. No tire people here? Can we abuse the tire people? No, I don't think we should. So tires, in their gross form, are essentially elastic. If you take a tire, you know its load, it's sitting in a bay area on a flat piece of ground, you know the diameter of the tire. If you measure the distance from the top of the tire to where the flat point is on the ground, okay, subtract that from the diameter, it gives you the tire deformation. That tire will deform proportional by an amount for its load. So if you know the actual gross load on the tire in the bay, you know the amount it deforms by, you actually have a tire stiffness. You have load per unit deformation. So the load divided by the deformation of the tire, and you can measure that in the shop. That gives you the tire deformation. That's always constant. So if we knew the force onto the tire during motion in the truck cycle, we can actually predict the tire deformation right away. If we know what that force is over a changing footprint area, and we can calculate that, that's actually calculable, it's just geometry, we can actually get the pressure on the ground at any instant. And if you've done your plate load test on the ground, you can now predict the ground deformation. All you need to know is the diadeformation, the grand deformation, you can work out the Roman resistance from that. So the question is, where do you get this force from? Despite the calculations, you can always ask me or someone else to do that, and I can show you how to do that on the back of an envelope. But where do you get the force from? Where would you measure force off a truck? How many people are running trucks today? Come on, let's have a show of hands. Who's running trucks? There must be someone running trucks. Yes, there's at least one, two, three people. No one else is running trucks. On your trucks, right now, you have a data system. It's working off a linear pressure transducer off your suspension, and it's giving you pressure. Your inside of your suspension cylinders are a constant area. You actually have force being measured right now off your suspension system. It's being measured live. By the second, 1 hertz, if you have a Caterpillar unit, every tenth of a second, 10 hertz on a Komatsu unit going straight to Comtrax. You have that data. You can measure real time every single force per second or per tenth of a second on this unit. You can plot how your rowing resistance is changing right around your mine just by measuring off your trucks. You don't need to bring in an expert. You can do it yourselves. This stuff is fairly straightforward to do once you've actually, and you get it reported straight to dispatch and get your rowing resistances. And I guarantee whatever rowing resistance you measure will be better than the assumptions you're making in your planning group. It'll be live, it'll be accurate, it'll tell you by time of year how it's deteriorating, by road quality how it's deteriorating, and it'll give you an indication of where your poor road sections are to be able to go and set some maintenance out there to improve your ground conditions. So I took a little bit of data. In fact, I took about 100,000 measurements in the field. And this is a hard rock mine in Australia. And they have some really good running surfaces. But I needed a benchmark to work against. So I measured on their really good, well-constructed roads about a 3.5% rowing resistance. We dream of that. I would love to have that in the oil sands. And then on their ramps, they had about 4.5% rowing resistance. But look at the variation. It does vary. So these are distributions of rowing resistance. This is for thousands upon thousands of measurements taken in the field. This is straight from suspension pressures, nowhere else. This is taken straight from suspension pressures. So this figure here, this is what I used to generate this. And when I actually measure rowing resistance from the torque from the motor, it comes out exactly the same. So that tells me this geometric approach, which is a lot simpler to measure, and you can get it real time all the time, we can see a very consistent measurement. This might be a little harder to see because of the size of the print, but there are floor plots here. This is actually in the oil sands. This is April, June, July, and October. So in April, we're just coming out of winter. Our main haul roads have about a 7.5% rowing resistance. Wow, that's already double what I'm seeing for the hard rock mine. In the pit and dump areas, I'm going between 8 to 11.5%, roughly around 9 to 10% rowing resistance. That's the good stuff. Then it starts to get out of hand. This is what happens when we move into June. This increases to 8.5 for the main haul roads. In the pit areas, it starts to look a little ragged, starts to separate out. So here we have somewhere between 9 to 13, this actually should be a one there. So it's 9 to 13%. So roughly around 11% rowing resistance. We get 1 month later, this increases by another 0.5%. And then when we get into October, when things start to cool down again and the oil sand starts to firm up, it comes back down to 6.5%, and it seems to have an average of somewhere between 8 to 9%. But overall, I'm able to tell these mines how their rowing resistance changes by year, and because how it changes by year, how much maintenance they need to be doing at each time of year on their roads, and what they need to be doing to reassess their road quality materials where they might need to recap in summer versus winter. Most of you don't have these issues. In the oil sands, we have the extreme to play with. But overall, the same principles would apply in any mine. And this is what allows me to do. If you have your GPS, which all of you should do nowadays on most of the trucks that have been purchased since about 2004, 2005, the GPS system, you can overlay the roam resistance on your mind map. And you can start to pick out all the hotspots. Well, this happens to be an oil sand mine. There isn't much where it isn't over 6.5%. So there's maintenance all the time, everywhere. There really is no choice. But in a hard rock mine, you'd be able to pick out the dump areas, the pit areas, and maybe the junctions. And remember, the junctions are probably the worst enemy for all of us. That's where things get pulped, and we have to rebuild all the time. But knowing how quickly they're deteriorating, getting a grader out there, getting a dozer to push the larger stuff, doing some rebuild, will help improve those possibilities and keep those costs down. And particularly if we have gone to something much bigger, because something much bigger is going to deteriorate our road surfaces faster. So we have costs associated with the amount of material we move. We have costs associated with the amount of fuel we're using. We have costs associated with the amount of infrastructure work we need to do with our road networks. We have costs associated with maintenance of those road networks. Costs associated with increased maintenance in the shop where we don't have as much redundancy with our units. So at the end of the day, our conclusions can only be that bigger means we have a lot of things to contend with. It just adds to our list of stuff to do. And smaller goes opposite to that. So I'm not going to tell you whether bigger is better. I'm just going to conclude this by saying, what do you think? If I was an engineer and a planner, which I am, part of the time, I would say, no, bigger is not better. If I was an OEM, which I am, part of the time, I would say, bigger is better. We just have to get better at how we manage the tools we're using. But you can't keep blaming it on something else. Where's the ownership associated with the bigger philosophy? It has to reside with the OEMs, and it has to reside with us as end users. So I think there's a partnership still to be had. There is still a huge amount to add into what we do in terms of planning, in terms of maintenance, in terms of scheduling. And these are some of the tools, as I've suggested, that we could use in terms of justifying why we should actually do some change in terms of how we manage some of our information. And if at the very least we can pull easy to grab information from our suspension cylinders, which is already there anyway, and as end users, you own that data, if no one's looking at it, this is an opportunity, a reason why it might be good to look at that data and get something out of it. So thank you all very much.
Thank you, Professor Tim Joseph. Questions?
Hello.
Hi.
Have you done a total cost of operational analysis comparing the different track sizes, and which results did you get from that comparison?
Yes, I have. And unfortunately, I can't share it with you because it was for a client. I can't give you any details, but when it comes down to total cost, it shows that bigger is not better. So overall cost in the system, if I look at capital versus numbers of units, capital always wins out. It always wins out, right? It's been priced that way by the OEMs for years, so you would have an advantage. And that was the big selling point. But you guys know that OEMs don't make money selling you a truck. They make money selling you parts, right? And lots of them. And what we found was that when we got into the bigger units, there were different types of problems, and they happen more often. Okay. If I think about John Mowbray, who did a whole bunch of maintenance management papers and books, and they're flooding out there, Paul Tomlinson from SME, who's been publishing for years. If I look at those philosophies, as things change, as things get more complicated, and we have technological more complication in our systems, there are different things that happen in terms of maintenance. And those different things require higher levels of expertise. So our labor costs have changed. We don't have as many of the trade laborers working on things. We have technicians and technologists at a much higher level. The costs of labor have gone up. the tools they require, the systems they require to do diagnosis. We're no longer the simple, you know, four-banger engine in our garage that we tinkered with and we could fix on the weekend. It now has a computer that scares most of us to death. Mine scares me to death. I won't go near it because I know as soon as I touch it, it goes wrong. But if I still had a four-banger engine, I know I could fix it, right? I can't even identify the carburetor now. I was like, where the hell's carburetor? I can't even find it. So I would say things have changed for us. So we not only are looking at a bigger size, we're looking at different technology. And so things have changed. It's the same philosophy. If we go to a bigger fleet, can we still use the same maintenance shops? Well, if we'd planned in the early days for big enough door openings, we could probably still get them in, but we can't. We end up fixing outside or we build a new shop. And you guys know as well as I do, if you're going to build a new shop to accommodate maintenance, it's cheaper to build a new one than try and retrofit the old one. You might as well drop the old shop and build a new one. In fact, I'm facing something right now at the university where we have a mechanical engineering building. I've just been told because the building leaks from the inside out when it rains, that's a scary thought, that means everything's corroding, the steel's corroding inside. To replace that building, it will cost me $25 million more just to try and refurbish. This is a no-brainer. I'm dropping the building. But now I've got 160 professors up in arms telling me I'm the devil taking their labs away. I'm sorry, guys. If it's going to cost me $25 million more, you're going to lose your building for about 3 years. I'll put you somewhere else. It's the same philosophy. It's going to cost us more to renovate than it is to rebuild. So when we're looking at these newer trucks, we never did go through that decision-making process in most mines. We tried to make do with the facilities we had. We increased the fleet. But we didn't think about what was needed to support it. Yes? Absolutely. So when I looked at it, I looked at mechanical and electric drive separately. Magrath focused on the mechanical drive systems. We did look at electric drive. When we tried to put both together, it became very confusing. But when you kept them separate, they still gave you the same overall result. The piece we added into this was considering the volumes moved, considering the thicknesses of road layers, the road resistance changes, which had never been considered before in the total cost of ownership. When we add those pieces again, it does change the picture. And that's why I've said that it really does depend on the location, the type of mine, the type of material you're moving. If you have high value ore, you may not need to have that perfect or close to perfect truck shovel match. You might be able to get away with a lot more redundancy in terms of your time in the system. With the low value ores, when the price is on the margin, which it has been for many of us for a number of years now, when we're looking at those circumstances, then we are, you know, we've been under a microscope now for at least 7-8 years, looking, trying to keep costs down. And so these things have been very important, looking at total cost of ownership. But we still haven't looked at the complete picture. We said we've looked at everything. We looked at the maintenance costs, the parts costs, ramp contracts versus mark contracts versus everything else. But we'd never tied it into the planning piece. And so there's always been that big disconnect between operations. Maintenance operations are now much closer together than they've ever been before. But planning engineering has not. It's still out there. You know, the plan's handed over to operations. They now execute it. But in doing that, we've never really investigated why it is we're seeing, for example, additional fuel usage around rolling resistance or around tire life, TKPH, those sorts of things. Do we have the right fill going into our bodies? Are we able to accomplish that? And are we looking at our blast coil? We already heard a, presentation about blast for wall stability, but in terms of production blasting, have we got a good handle on what our right blast quality is to minimize our costs at our most expensive point, which is probably our crushers? So that's still our biggest power draw. Are we minimizing that point? What are we using in terms of power required at our excavators, whether they are hydraulic or rope? So there's a whole bunch of things we still haven't included in the mix. We've looked at overall bird's eye view in terms of costs, but it takes a little bit of drilling down to figure out, okay, we're actually missing some stuff here. So I do take your points, and you know, the things you're making in some very specific cases in low value minerals, yes, I think we do find where we don't have as much problem associated with fatigue on structures because the roads are a reasonable quality, because we are in hard rock environments, we are moving copper, predominantly minerals, things like that. We're not looking for the high value stuff to actually offset. It does become much more important. But one of the dangers I've always seen when we're looking at using things like truck shovel match to justify, can we keep that up? And the answer is we can't. We can say we want to aim for this, we're going to try and target this, but we always get out of mismatch associated with cycle times, we end up with bunching, and so that management piece becomes a lot more effort at the dispatch level to try and manage that system. But no, some very good points, sir. Yeah.
Did we lose it here? I think we need to thank you, you're Dr. Joseph. We've obviously overran our time limit here. He's available for some questions if you guys want to talk to him after the fact. How about a round of applause for Dr. Joseph? So we're now officially 30 minutes behind schedule. Let's take a...